My name is Ed Goldberg, and I am speaking to you with Matthew Flaming. Did I say that right?
Yes, you did.
Okay, Matthew, welcome. Well, you're a Portlander now, so I don't have to say necessarily welcome to Portland.
Well, I was away for several years, so it's great to be back.
Okay, but welcome to KBOO. I bet it's the first time you've been here.
It is indeed. Thank you so much for having me, Ed.
Yeah, sure. The title of your book is The Kingdom of Ohio. Your name is spelled Flaming, and it's published by a Putnam label, Amy Einhorn Books. Let me tell a little about you, and you can object or not if you want to, all right?
Fair enough.
Matthew Flaming has spent a fair chunk of his adult life creating and consuming content on the internet, but the web has never been a medium he's preferred for self-expression. This is true?
This is true, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I took it off your website, so I know. Born in L.A., went to a lefty liberal arts college, Hampshire College.
That's right.
You like movies, even questionable ones like Hudson Hawk.
I think Hudson Hawk has a great appeal that people tend to overlook. It's a huge amount of fun. It's very tongue-in-cheek.
Bruce Willis is funny in it, but isn't that the movie where he's being tortured and somebody says, "What can we do to make you talk?" And he says, "Play some rap music."
Exactly.
Yeah, that's my favorite line in the movie. You've lived in Portland, Oregon, on and off for a while. We can talk about this for half hour if you want to. You met your wife in a class at Portland State in Jewish magic and mysticism.
Yes, I did.
Do you want to talk about numerology and the Zohar while we're here?
Well, it's a subject that interests me a lot. And in fact, I'm working on another novel now that deals exactly with those sorts of subjects. But maybe we'll focus on this book for now.
And this book for that's probably a wise idea. Okay, The Kingdom of Ohio. For want of a better... To describe this book, I would have to say it's an alternate historical reality. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's fair.
Okay. Yeah. There really was no Kingdom of Ohio in the universe that we're accustomed to.
There was no Kingdom of Ohio. A lot of the material that the Kingdom of Ohio is drawn from in the book is historically accurate. Most of the footnotes in the book do correspond with real sources. And in point of fact, a lot of the elements that made this up, including a small colony of isolated Frenchmen on the Ohio frontier, did indeed happen, but never was a kingdom as such.
Well, there was a real Baron of Arizona for a while, too, based on a Spanish land grant, so some of this stuff actually did happen. Now, I was thinking, I'm a big fan of the Flashman books, George MacDonald Fraser, and he always has footnotes in it, and his footnotes are always historically accurate, and the sources are always accurate. The same is true of your book?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
The main character is a young man named Peter Force. He's a kind of a self-educated engineer. His father was a mining engineer. He understands mining and digging holes, and he lives in Idaho. But when we meet him, he's kind of heaved up on the shores of New York. What has he come to New York for?
I think that he has really come to New York to reinvent himself in a way. He's fleeing from some tragedies that occurred in his past on the Idaho frontier where he lived with his father. And like so many people, he comes to the metropolis looking for a better future.
Okay. I guess that'll do. When we first meet, well, the thing that starts this whole thing rolling is a photograph. Right at the very beginning, the opening of the book, there's a man running an antique store who comes across a photograph. Can you describe what's in the photograph?
Yes, of course. It's a black and white photograph that shows three people sitting at a table in a seedy dance hall from the turn of what's now the last century. There are two men and a woman. One of the men is dressed elegantly in tuxedo tails, immaculately tailored, and is immediately recognizable as the inventor, Nikola Tesla. The other man is ragged. One of his hands is bandaged. He's unkempt. And the woman has a strange intensity on her face as she sits between them and seems to be, in a way, caught between these two men.
What is it with Nikola Tesla? You know, Nikola Tesla, who was a fairly obscure person, oh, say, 60, 70 years ago, there probably would have been... You know, if you ask the average person who is Nikola Tesla, they probably would have thought that he was Mussolini's, you know, right-hand man or something. But in the last 50 years, Tesla has been characters in films. David Bowie played him in a movie. He's appeared as a character in novels and plays. He's been in nonfiction books. And always as a counterbalance to Edison, who, you know, we think of Edison as the great benign genius, who was really a kind of a creep and a mean guy, and Tesla was his opposite number. What attracted you to Tesla?
Well, I think personally, I was really drawn to Tesla because he represents, to me, a very different view of technology than and science than what we experience for the most part today. For Tesla, there was a really metaphysical, almost magical aspect to technology. So, for example, he was involved in research with X-rays shortly after their discovery, like many people were, and he called them shadowgraph rays, which is a phrase from a Kierkegaard work, actually. And he thought that in addition to letting people see through matter, X-rays could potentially let people see the soul, the delicate spiritual material within objects. So this notion of technology potentially being linked to spirituality, being linked to a deeper understanding of ourselves, I think was very compelling for me, and it's compelling for a lot of people, which is why he's come up in so many movies and plays recently.
This is not substantially different from the alleged belief that some pre-literate societies, when first seeing a photograph of themselves, believed that the person who took the photograph had captured their soul.
I hadn't thought of that, but you're right. There's definitely a parallel there. Absolutely. And, you know, I think that there was probably something very shocking at the time in seeing people's, you know, bones laid bare there on film. This is my most intimate inner self that suddenly is being drawn out.
Well, most people are more afraid to have their underwear showing than their bones. I mean, this is literally true. The year is 1900, and when Peter Forrest comes to New York, he gets a job digging the subways. And this is really going on. And the underground railways in New York were being built in those days, and they had steam cars originally, which was must have been a hideous experience going underground in those. But he meets an interesting crew. You have a crew of immigrants and American laborers. Tell us about the crew.
Well, the crew that he's working with is really drawn from all corners of the world. There are Italians, Irishmen, Englishmen, and also native-born Americans. And at the time, New York was the biggest Italian city in the world, the biggest Jewish city in the world, the second biggest Polish city in the world. So people were really flooding from all corners of the earth and embodying the melting pot society there, perhaps better than anywhere else in the world. So the people that he encounters are intended to reflect this very diverse group with very different backgrounds, but they're unified in their experiences of, number one, struggling against what were at the time very difficult conditions for workers, and also trying to reinvent themselves as Americans.
You also use, as many people do in historical fiction, real historical characters like J.P. Morgan and Thomas Edison and Tesla, as I've said. What did you feel any need to be true to the real, quote-unquote, real characters as we know them of these people, or were they simply characters in your book?
Well, I did a fair amount of research on all of the real historical figures in the book, read biographies. And, of course, you can never know to what extent you're actually being true. All we can do is, you know, kind of interpolate from the remaining material. But I did want to certainly stay true to the spirit of these men and write in a way that didn't portray them contrary to the historical evidence that's left to us and capture some sense of who they were, although a lot of the specific things they're saying and doing in the book are, of course, fabrication.
Mm-hmm. What is your conceptualization of J.P. Morgan? He's certainly a seminal figure in the economic life of the country at that time. How did you perceive him to be?
J.P. Morgan was a very interesting man. We certainly know that he was what we call today a control freak. He was very domineering, a very forceful personality. One way, I think, in which he differed from bankers these days is there was at the time this conception of the moral authority of wealth. So to quote Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. With great riches comes great responsibility at the time. And he made speeches about this, about how it is beholden upon those with this sort of influence to steer society in constructive directions. Now, you might, and probably should, argue with his vision of what the right direction was, but this notion of being beholden to society and doing things like supporting the United States government when it faced bankruptcy, which he did on two occasions, I think is something that has been forgotten or gone by the wayside now.
Well, how does this differ from noblesse oblige? You know, it's almost the same kind of a thing, isn't it? This feeling that you need to have a certain amount of largesse toward the peasants, or your moral authority is gone.
I think it's very related. I think it's kind of a direct descendant of that aristocratic notion that was translated onto American soil and took a slightly different form. But it was certainly something that drove a lot of his actions. And also, one thing that we know about him is he was a very lonely man. He wasn't very communicative. He had one great love of his life, his first wife, who died on their honeymoon of tuberculosis.
Isn't that awful?
It really is.
Yeah.
It really is. Money can't buy happiness.
That's the truth. Just ask the Kennedys. They'll tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
And Edison. Edison is an enigmatic figure. He wasn't in his own time. In his own time, he was considered a hero and a genius and the greatest living inventor. And he gave us the light bulb and the phonograph and, you know, blah, 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 ad infinitum. But he was he was wily and crafty and not all that honest in his business dealings.
Well, Edison, in some ways, was the original nerd. Whereas Tesla was something more like a stage magician. He was polished. He was very elegant in his presentation. Edison, first of all, was very socially awkward. He was mostly deaf, so he didn't interact very well with others. He spoke in these short quips. He did try to maintain a public image that was of the kind of good old country bumpkin inventor, but in point of fact, he was pretty unscrupulous about borrowing other people's inventions, claiming credit for various pieces of technology. And in fact, one of his first encounters with Tesla, which started out the rivalry between the two men, took this form. Tesla came to the United States and was looking for work with Edison. And Edison, at the time, was installing electrical generators on ocean liners, luxury liners, and he couldn't get them to work. He couldn't get the transmission to work right. There were insulation problems, and so he employed Tesla and said, "Tesla, if you can fix these problems, I'll pay you $1,000. Tesla goes out, fixes the problems, comes back, and Edison says, "Oh, sorry, I was joking."
That's pretty funny. Yeah.
And typically of Tesla, he was a man who operated without written contracts. He had this idea that we're involved in a spiritual pursuit. What we say should be enough.
Yeah, and as one of the Warner brothers said, I think it was Jack Warner, an oral contract isn't worth the paper it's written on. So.
Neither then nor now.
Yeah. This is kind of a throwaway, and it's not really in the book, but can you describe briefly the alternating current versus direct current fight between Edison and Tesla? It goes to character, I think, here.
Oh, absolutely. So at the time, the turn of the century, direct current power generation and transmission was the norm. It was much simpler to figure out how to do a direct current, but one of the main problems with it is that it wasn't very efficient, so you couldn't transmit power for long distances. Still, since it was the available technology, it was what Edison was using in all of his generators, all of his electrical lighting systems, and he was backed by many of the most powerful bankers in the country in this enterprise, including J.P. Morgan. And Tesla's first great breakthrough, he had numerous inventions, but his first great breakthrough was alternating current electricity. He figured out how you could use essentially a pair of rotating magnets to generate electricity in this way that was much more efficient. You could transmit it for hundreds of miles. It was much cheaper to generate, but it was also not in usage at the time. Tesla found backing to build his AC systems, most notably George Westinghouse backed him. And what followed over the next few years was essentially this technical war between Edison and Tesla, where Edison's tactics essentially were fear and deception for the most part. So he would do things like he would round up stray dogs and cats and electrocute them using AC electricity to prove it was dangerous.
What a guy, huh?
Yeah, he actually arranged for the world's first electric chair to be built using AC power in order to defame it. Now, eventually, AC power won out. When you plug your when you plug something into a wall socket, it's AC power that you're using. Mm-hmm. But it took over a decade for this campaign of deception to finally give way to what was obviously the more advantageous AC system.
And destroying Tesla's reputation in the bargain.
Yes.
Yeah. I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Matthew Flaming, F-L-A-M-I-N-G. Title of his book is The Kingdom of Ohio, and it's published by Amy Einhorn Books. Kingdom of Ohio. There's a young woman in this book, the one in the photograph. Her name is Sherrianne Toledo. And it's always been interesting to me that there's a Toledo in Spain and there's a Toledo in Ohio, although the mm-hmm. two are quite different, I must say. But she comes from the family that in your alternate history of the United States is of the Kingdom of Ohio. Tell us a little bit about Sherrianne.
Well, Sherrianne enters the book as a very enigmatic figure. When Peter Force, the protagonist who's come to New York to work on the subway crews, first encounters her, she's essentially living as a vagabond on the streets. And she begins to relate this story of her upbringing in this place called the Kingdom of Ohio that nobody's heard of, that doesn't match up with our sense of history. And as she relates this background, she fills in these very vivid details. She was a mathematical prodigy growing up. Her father had this kind of mini Versailles in the American Midwest. And essentially what she's doing in the story, and I think one of the things that drew me to write this book to begin with, is exploring the way in which our personal narratives shape our identity and the way that those personal narratives often come into some degree of conflict with the world around us, with our common understanding of history. And essentially the importance of remaining true to one's own story. And
are you what you say you are? Is that basically what it is?
I don't know if it's you are what you say you are. We often mislead people, but we all, I think, have a sense of some internal narrative. So people will say things like, I wasn't being myself today, or he's acting out of character. And okay, of course, when I say I'm not being myself today, I don't mean it literally. Who else could I be, right? But
the possibilities are infinite,
well,
I suppose.
Maybe so. But I think what we actually mean is I wasn't being the self who's supposed to star in my own story. I wasn't conforming with this internal vision of myself as, you know, the person who has, oh, I don't know, struggled against the odds, et cetera, et cetera.
I want to talk about the subways in New York, because the subways in New York, as functional as they are, you know, and I'm born and raised in New York, so I've been mm-hmm. riding the subway since I was like no years old. Mm-hmm. And it always seemed to me that they were kind of fun. Even when I was a little kid, it was fun to ride the subway. Mm-hmm. You know, it gives you a love of trains and it's spooky underground, blah, you know, the whole
yeah.
thing. But I never considered the subway tunnels to have a function beyond just a tube to get you from one place to the other. I don't know how much you want to give away about your book, but tell us a little bit about what's going on in the subway tunnels, if you can.
Well, without going into too much detail, the book, a lot of the book depicts the construction of the first subways under the city, which is a massive, massive undertaking. People are essentially creating these miles of tunnel using hand tools.
And dynamite. Yeah.
And there's this notion in the book that in addition to just serving a purpose of transportation, the subway tunnels are acting in this, play a key role in this struggle that's going on between Morgan, Edison, and Tesla to control the development of technology and control both the shape of the city and the shape of the future.
And Sherrianne, who may be a genius and maybe a little crazy also, mm-hmm. Has theorized, I don't know, again, if I'm treading too heavily on the plot, or you can tell me, she's theorized possibilities that she wants to talk to Mr. Tesla about. This is one of the reasons that she's come to New York, is to attempt to have an interview with Mr. Tesla.
Right. So Sherry, one of the things that's motivating Sherry Ann is she's trying to make sense of her own story. She's maybe delusional, but not completely out of touch with reality. So she realizes, I remember these things that don't correspond with anyone else's experience of the world. So am I nuts here? Is there some way to explain this? And she has her own ideas, but she does come to New York to talk to Tesla, as, exactly as you said, to try and make sense of what's happened to her and account for all of these things. And the subways do factor in to that, although I don't think I want to go into further detail.
Yeah, you want the readers to discover that
exactly.
For themselves. Something that came in way out of left field was the Roanoke colony. And that, I mean, that's all I'll say about it. I'll let you say any more if you wish. But I lived in Virginia for 18 years. And if you live in Virginia, there's a bunch of things that you find out about real fast. And one is the Roanoke colony, which is a colony that just basically disappeared. There were people there who were colonists, and then suddenly there weren't. And nobody knows why. Nobody could find any trace of them, the writings that people left, their diaries, their logs, just end.
Mm-hmm.
When you brought this in, were you just trying to stick something in that fascinated you totally and work it into this, or how did you manage to bring that in?
Well, I think there's part of it was, yes, I find this stuff fascinating. It's a great story, and having the opportunity to work in it was delightful. When I figured out I could do it, I sort of rubbed my hands and chuckled. I think a piece of it, though, was in the same way that there's this Kingdom of Ohio, one of the interesting things in the book to me is looking at historical mysteries, looking at the places where our historical understanding falls short, where there have been events that either tend to be forgotten because they're not part of our understanding of progress, or have become little footnotes to the American story writ large. And Roanoke, to me, was kind of emblematic of this is an America that never quite happened. This is one of the first colonies in the United States. It was
Virginia Dare, the first child born in the United States, was in the Roanoke colony.
Right.
Yeah.
And it just ends, as you say. So it sort of hints at another America that could have come into being, another future that we don't know anything about. And our understanding of history is very interesting to me, because it is, in a literal sense, where the stories that we tell about the past become accepted as fact. Now, most of the history, though, that we consider important, it's ultimately narrative. It's not factual. So our understanding of, let's say, the election of Barack Obama, we know a lot about the facts and figures, who voted for who, et cetera, et cetera. But the meaningful story there is one that escapes the facts. It's about a change in political sentiment, let's say, or, you know, a new sense of renewal and hope, or a reactionary gesture against what happened in the past year. So it's this more intangible human understanding and interpretation that allows us to glue the few facts that we know about history together into something coherent. So the places where we come up short doing that, like Roanoke, are very, very interesting to me.
There's another, not overtly stated in the book, although I guess Tesla does it, just to put down Edison. There's a thing about the theoretician versus the engineer, the person who is the idea man and the person who is the implementer.
Mm-hmm.
Tesla sees Edison as a grunter, somebody who just, you know, by main force and ignorance works his way through every possible combination until he finally lands on something and discovers it, unless he steals an idea. Whereas Tesla is this grand theoretician who can also put together a machine if he needs to. Is this something you think about often? It occurs to me that this is a mindset that you may have.
Well, I think it's – so while writing this book, I supported myself doing software engineering. And it's something that I saw there fairly often, this notion of – well, one approach to creating something is the Edison approach, you know. Invention is 99% perspiration, 1% inspiration. Whereas the other approach is much more holistic. And says, rather than sorting through all the possible experiments, let's step back and try and understand how something is going to work holistically. And I think that this might relate back to two different understandings of history. One, which is a understanding that's much more human-centric, much more about what's the story here. And another that is much more focused on facts and figures. And, okay, so given what we know about electoral patterns, how can we make sense in a predictive way that Barack Obama won? And that ignores the spirit of the times.
Mm-hmm. What's next for you?
I'm currently working on another novel. It's set in the Ottoman Empire in the 17th century. As we spoke about earlier, it does involve Jewish mysticism and magic. And I think I'll stop there for fear of giving away too much.
Yeah, when you get a name like Latoledan, or mm-hmm. I always wonder about that, whether that's a Converso name or not. You know, it's one of the hidden Jew names. But this is mm-hmm. another topic for another time. Really, I right. can't really start this at the end of this interview. I would have to say that when I first picked up this book, I was amazed right off the bat about the imagination that you brought to it. I think there's, I really mean that. There's a lot of really good speculative thinking in this book, and it's a page turner, and you even get a bit of a potboiler at the end with people running around and blowing themselves up and in subway tunnels, and what happens as a result of that. And there's a lot of humanity to the story as well, because the character of Peter Force is really the soul driving this book. So thanks very much for coming in.
Well, thanks again for having me.
Sure.
It's a pleasure.
I've been speaking with Matthew Flaming, FLAMING, The Kingdom of Ohio, and it's published by Amy Ihern Books. Thanks again.
Thank you.